Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and this is the Blackwell Interview of the Month for April 2011. I'm very pleased to say that my guest on this programme is Greg Muttit, author of Fuel on the Fire, Oil and Politics in Occupied Iraq. Greg was previously co-director of campaigning charity Platform, which seeks to expose the environmental and human impacts of the oil industry. His interest in Iraq began at the time of the anti-war demonstrations in 2003, and has grown to the extent that there are probably few people in the world today with such an in-depth understanding of the part that oil played in the decision to go to war, and the role it has continued to play since. Not for him the blanket official dismissals that oil had anything to do with it, nor the elaborate conspiracy theories favoured by some opponents of the war. Instead, Greg presents a fascinating and often page-turning account of the ways in which oil and politics have intertwined throughout Iraq's modern history, and especially under the occupation of the last 8 years. Surprisingly, this is the first book to focus on that relationship, and the result is that issues which previously seemed opaque suddenly become clear. This book is certainly one of my top non-fiction recommendations of the year so far. And so to the interview. Most people, when asked, have strong views on whether the war in Iraq was about oil. I began by asking Greg why he thought oil was such a particularly polarising issue.
I think at the centre of that was the sheer weight of official denial that the US and British governments didn't see it as politically feasible to accept that there was an oil interest. And this is in contrast to the Gulf War in 1991, where politicians were a lot more comfortable saying oil was the major factor here, or a major factor here. I think to a lot of people, you look at Iraq as the second or third largest oil reserves in the world, it's quite obvious that that's a strategic interest there. And so, I think to a lot of people, you look at it, okay, there's a degree of obviousness. To the other side, no, absolutely not, we can't accept this, and there are all these other rationales. What hollowed out the middle in between that was, I think, a lot of people were, especially commentators, journalists, felt nervous about losing credibility, about being seen as associated with an anti-imperialist position or associated with the left by talking about the oil agenda. And I think the government did a very effective job of saying, well, if you think this, then you must be some crazy conspiracy theorist. And I think that dragged a lot of the centre into this government position that, of course, it has nothing to do with oil. And Rumsfeld famously said it has nothing to do with oil, literally nothing to do with oil. Which, in my view, is it's as absurd a position as to say it was only about oil and nothing else.
I'm really looking at an exploration of that, isn't it? The degree to which it was about oil. And you make the point early on in the book that it's a rather under-examined question. And there's been so much written about the war and its causes and consequences. This, given its importance, is relatively under-examined, isn't it?
I'm to this day baffled by the fact that no one else has written this book. I think if you look at Iraqi politics, you can't get away from oil. Oil is at the centre of politics. It utterly dominates the economy, in fact. That's an understatement. And so you can't understand Iraq without looking at oil. At the same time, you've got this huge polarisation about, was the war about oil? Wasn't it about oil? So it seems like, to me, it's a very natural question to ask. What happened to the oil? Lots of people are saying this is a war for oil. The government was saying it wasn't. What happened next? And so, from 2003 onwards, I applied myself to trying to observe what happened and to try to answer that question.
As you just mentioned, this is a question you've been looking at really since the war began. Tell me what attracted you personally to it. What was it that inclined you to investigate it?
My first engagement in issues to do with Iraq was in February 2003. I was on the march through London in opposition to the war. At the time, I knew very little about Iraq. You know, I knew where it was, and that it had a lot of oil, and I knew who Saddam Hussein was, but that was about the limit of it. But I went on that march because I found it fundamentally unacceptable that my government, the British government, was going to war in what to me seemed like such a clearly self-interested manner, and illegally. And, you know, there were a million or two people States with the same view on that day. So they got involved in Iraq through objecting to what the British government was doing in participating in this war. At the time, I was working for a campaign charity called Platform. It focused on the oil industry, looked at human rights issues, development issues, environmental issues, focused on the oil industry. So I was in a position to look at this question, and perhaps I was predisposed to be interested in it. But as I said, on that march, probably the banner that was more prevalent than any other was No Blood for Oil. And so a natural question to ask is, well, what's going to happen to the oil? Perhaps we can track this. So after that march, I started reading oil industry publications, you know, trade journals like Oil and Gas Journal and Petroleum Intelligence Weekly and so on. And what I found was that those journals were talking about Iraq in a very different way from how the mainstream media were. They portrayed a real level of excitement among oil companies, saying, this is the big one, this is where we really want to be. Now, contrast that with, it has literally nothing to do with oil. So,
it's like oil companies licking their lips, that's a phrase that sprang to my mind, when they saw the prospect of Iraqi oil being opened up.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think licking their lips is exactly what they were doing. So, over the months after the war began in March 2003, I read these industry publications, I went to some industry conferences because I was based in London. And what started to emerge was a policy, a set of ideas for what the oil industry wanted to happen to Iraq. And I started to see that the American government and the British government were saying the same things. Over that period, actually not until 2004, I started writing about this, and because of the level of interest in the subject, and because there's almost nothing else being written about it, there was quite a bit of interest in that. And then after I first went to Iraq, which was in May 2005, what I discovered was that being in London, as an oil industry centre, it's one of the oil industry capitals of the world, it was much easier for me to find out what was happening to Iraqi oil than it was for an Iraqi ambassador all back there. And so I had a position which gave me an opportunity and in some ways a responsibility to try and share that information with friends and colleagues and people in general in Iraq. And so that's what I found myself doing, using my geographical location in London to research what was going on with the oil, share it with Iraqi partners, and then they would engage in discussion there, share information with other Iraqis and try and stimulate debate. So that's what I found myself doing.
I wanted to take a step back. You've already mentioned that Iraq has very sizable deposits of oil. But just paint the picture of its strategic importance of the world oil trade, because I think it'd be quite useful to contextualise its importance in the politics too.
Well, without going too far into statistics, Iraq only accounts for probably about 3% of the world's oil production, which sounds not that significant. The USA, for instance, accounts for a lot more. But when it becomes important is when you look at the volume of oil that exists in the ground, what's called the reserves. On that measure, Iraq has 10%. What that means is that because Iraq is extracting oil at a fairly slow rate, 3% of the world's total compared to possessing 10% of the world's oil, over time, as other countries deplete their oil more quickly, Iraq will become a more significant player within the oil market. It will have more of the oil that is left over. It's a finite resource and it gets depleted. So Iraq itself has a huge quantity of oil, which is relatively undeveloped because the production is so low compared to its share of reserves. It also has, geologists believe, more potential oil yet to be found, particularly in the Western Desert area, than any other country. Estimates vary, but the kind of midpoint of geological estimates is that there's as much to be found still in Iraq as is already known about. So having 10% of the oil, that could double to 20% of the world's oil.
And this is very important in a context in which oil companies have to each year report on what they have in reserve versus what they have extracted. And that plays a big part, doesn't it, in their valuation?
Well, both for the oil companies themselves, who need to keep finding more oil, and for the oil market as a whole, and especially Western governments who are concerned about the oil price and the dynamics of the market, for both what they were seeing was diminishing returns in oil production and development around the world. So companies were moving into ever deeper water, as we all saw last year with the BP disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Companies were moving into deeper water, into more remote places, trying to tap smaller quantities of oil. And this was getting ever more difficult for the oil companies to keep expanding their production, to keep their shareholders happy, and for the Western governments to see oil production stay ahead of oil demand so as to keep the price down. And as we saw, the price climbed, it's climbed again to now $110 a barrel. So actually what we saw is a commonality of interest between oil companies that wanted to get their own hands on reserves and Western governments who wanted to see more reserves developed. And as they were getting diminishing returns elsewhere in the world, they were feeling the need. This is at the beginning of the last decade, at the beginning of the 21st century, they were seeing the need to tap back into the really giant reserves of the world, and that means the Middle East. And one other thing to say about this is, not only does Iraq itself have huge quantities of oil, its neighbours do too. Between five countries in the Middle East, there's more than 60% of the total, with Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the Emirates and Iran, as well as Iraq. And if you look at a map of the Middle East, of the Persian Gulf region, and you imagine Iran, Saudi Arabia on either side of it, with Iraq and Kuwait on the top, it looks like an arch. And Iraq has been described as the keystone of that arch. So it's from Iraq that it is possible to influence the whole region. It's at the very centre of the 60% of the world's oil.
I was really interested in this idea of the sort of exemplarity of Iraq, that if Iraq was sort of broken and tamed and re-educated and made to be a good member of OPEC, which meant, you know, getting its production and its pricing the way that the Western world wanted, then that would have knock-on beneficial effects on for the West among the other Gulf economies, oil economies.
Yeah, that really came out in the documents I got hold of in researching this book. British government documents talked about Iraq serving as a strong exemplar to other countries in the region. Using a more military metaphor, the oil companies the six oil companies got together to fund a lobbying effort to try and shape the Iraqi oil policy. And the lobbying organisation they work with described it as a beachhead to change oil investment policies around the broader Middle East. And so partly it's the geographical position, being neighbouring to all these other great oil countries with enormous oil reserves, and the influence through being located there. And in all of these countries, oil production is either completely or to a large extent nationalised at the moment. I think the other thing that they really wanted to do was the balance of power in the oil market is cyclical and changes with the oil price. A cycle will last 10 or 15 years, but what tends to happen is when the oil price is low, the oil-producing countries tend to be more desperate to expand their oil production so as to get more revenues. And they want companies to come in and help them expand their production. So you saw this, for instance, in the late 90s. The oil price went as low as $10 a barrel in 1998. And oil-producing countries really needed help to produce more oil. And so the balance of power was very much in favour of international oil companies, the BPs and Shells of the world at that point. And, of course, the more individual countries tried to increase their production so as to get more revenues because of the low oil price, the more it forced down the oil price. So it got locked into this is why it's cyclical, it got locked into this low oil price phase. What started to happen in the last decade was that the balance of power swung the other way, and especially as the oil price climbed. Now, although the BPs and Shells and Exxons were recording record profits, the sheer scale of the really high oil price wasn't entirely in their interests because it swung power back in favour of the oil-producing countries that they have to negotiate with. And these countries started to say, well, actually, we're getting very high revenues from our current levels of production. We don't really need your technology or your finance. Rates of production are plenty high enough for us, as it is, thank you very much. And so they didn't need to expand production, and so the oil price remained high because the supply overall remained constrained, so it stayed in a high price phase. Now, I think strategically, the way the companies and the Western governments looked at Iraq was if they could open the taps in Iraq, and they're talking now about increasing oil production from 2.5 million barrels a day to perhaps 12.5 million barrels a day. That's adding 10 million barrels a day to the oil market. That's more than 10% of world oil production. That's huge. If they could do that and thereby crash the price, that swings things back into a low price environment. And what I saw in British government documents that I got hold of in researching this book was that they wanted to use Iraq as an advocate of low prices within OPEC and thereby weaken OPEC as a whole. So there's this bigger strategic agenda to weaken OPEC, weaken the oil-producing countries through using massively expanded oil production in Iraq together with the oil multinationals.
In American Republican ideology, when does the idea of actually using hard power to crack Saddam's Iraq become prevalent? Because you've got a very interesting paper that Paul Wolfowitz wrote back in, the late 1970s, which seems to crystallize some of those ideas.
Yeah, it was one of the first things Paul Wolfowitz did in working for the government. It was in about 1979. He was hired to... I think he was a young man at the time. He was hired to look at where there might be threats to US power that hadn't been thought about. And he chose to look at the Persian Gulf, and he looked at threats to oil production, threats to US interests in oil production. Of course, the region looked very different at that time. And he identified Iraq as a major threat to US interests because Iraqi political culture tends to be anti-Western, partly because of their experience of having the Western oil companies operating there on extremely unfair terms for 50 years up to the early 70s. And so he looked at Iraq and said, well, Iraq looks like a powerful country within the region, and with anti-Western political attitudes, this could be a real threat. And during the 80s, when Iraq was at war with Iran for 8 years, the kind of balance of US political opinion was kind of favouring Iraq over Iran. Henry Kissinger famously said, too bad they can't both lose.
Well, in terms of backing, it was Iraq that got the backing, wasn't it, in terms of expertise and material?
Especially intelligence. The Iraqis were given satellite imagery of where Iranian units were and so on. The Americans used their weight internationally to prevent arms shipments to Iran. But, of course, we know that what they really wanted, and we saw this with the Contra affair, what they really wanted was both sides to lose, but Iran to lose more than Iraq. But during that period, there were some individuals who were at fairly junior levels within the administration who were saying, actually, we have more concerns about Iraq than Iran. And Paul Wolfowitz was one of those. A protege of his called Zami Khalilzad was another. Now, Khalilzad went on to become US ambassador to Iraq in 2005-06. So, going back more than 20 years, there were voices within the US political establishment who were concerned about Iraq. These same voices, during the 1999 Gulf War, called for the US to continue on to Baghdad and to topple Saddam Hussein, not to simply liberate Kuwait. And those voices got ever louder through the course of the 1990s. They established something called the Project for a New American Century in the late 1990s, one of whose major aims was to bring about military action in Iraq. And a lot of those people got jobs in the Bush administration when it took power in 2001. So there is a long history of people in the US administration having an interest in Iraq, being concerned about Iraq. I think one really interesting thing there, which the American journalist James Mann has pointed out, was that Paul Wolfowitz, who is seen as one of the most principled of the advocates of war in Iraq, he consistently, through the 90s, talked about the tyranny of Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was the reason why the US needed to get more involved in Iraq. What James Mann pointed out in his book Rise of the Balkans is that Wolfowitz's first engagement in, or first thinking about Iraq back in 1979, wasn't about Saddam Hussein. It wasn't about dictatorship, it wasn't about human rights. It was about US interests in oil in the broader Persian Gulf region. That I thought was fascinating.
I thought it was fascinating when the invasion actually happened in March 2003, the contrast that you drew between the Americans, the Allies, attention to Iraq's economic assets and to its cultural assets. Mm-hmm. And you quoted I think it was a senior museum figure, who had accused the Iraqis of being too retentionist. And I thought retentionist was an absolutely fascinating word, because you apply it in a cultural context. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the same Western attitude towards Iraqi oil seemed to prevail. It was basically saying the Iraqis are not competent, even the Saddam regime, they're not competent to manage this asset. They're being too retentionist, and in fact, it needs to be broken up and opened up so that we can actually show them how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was very interesting to see that those two kind of attitudes working in parallel.
I was interested in the parallel between these two different types of wealth that you find under the ground on these archaeological records of ancient civilizations. The first civilizations of humanity. And the other is this modern wealth of petroleum. What was happening at the time was that the official policy bodies, and I think this came out most strongly from things like the International Energy Agency, which is the OECD's energy unit. The International Energy Agency was saying Iraq needs to invest in its oil. The global oil market needs more oil. We've got a supply constraint. And so we've got to see more investment from countries like Iraq. To me, that sounded very close to what this guy William Pellstein was saying about Iraq being too retentionist about its cultural artifacts. The IEA was saying the world, the West, oil consumers in general, need more oil to be produced so that we can have low prices. It's not for Iraqis to decide what they do with their oil. It's not for them to decide what's in their best interest, how to develop it, with whom, at what rate, etc. The world needs it. And so the subtext of that was, if the Iraqis aren't going to do it in the way that the world needs it, then we'll have to teach them, we'll have to encourage them, perhaps even we'll have to make them do it in that way.
But there wasn't any well-developed blueprint for that process, was there? There wasn't like a secret plan. It's quite shocking to see how often things are being made up on the hoof. Someone's brought in and there isn't really any plan, although there may be a sort of direction that America wants to move in. Mm-hmm. Nobody had sort of done a blueprint.
That's true. It is surprising. There are ideas talked about, but I think the major reason there wasn't more of a plan was that the war was really driven by certain elements within the US administration, primarily the people in the Department of Defense at the Pentagon and Vice President Dick Cheney's office. And there were others in the administration, especially in the State Department and the CIA, who were more skeptical about it. Now, the people in the Pentagon had this, I think they were quite intoxicated by the supremacy of US military power. And I think their idea was that all you have to do is attack Iraq, bomb Iraq, remove the Saddam Hussein regime, and freedom, in inverted commas, as they saw it, would blossom. And a model democracy on the US model would arise as soon as repression were removed. Now, to most of us, that looks extremely naive. I think there was a fascinating dichotomy here between the neocon hawks, as they were called, and the doves in the State Department. There have been lots of books written about Iraq, and if you read the American books written about it, the war is strongly characterised as the sensible people in the State Department, to Colin Powell and everyone below him, who said, well, we're not sure, we think this war is going to be a mess. We're not convinced of it. Perhaps it wasn't leading to request for his opposition to the war, but they raised concerns about it. Contrast that with the Wolfowitzes of the world and the Doug Fifes of the world and the Don Rumsfelds of the world in the Pentagon, who was saying, we've got to do it, we've got to remove this tyrant and everything will be great after that. So the narrative of the war, in especially American writing about it, was you have sensible people expressing concerns and ideological idiots saying, let's go in there and it will be great. Now, I would challenge that kind of good-bad dichotomy, because I think what happened was that the neocons and the people in the Defense Department, whether they were neocons or not, tended to be, as I say, intoxicated by US military power and thought that that was enough. We don't have to make plans because we bombed the place, freedom will arrive, probably Ahmed Jalabi, he's a great Democrat, and Iraqis will see that and see the advantages of it, and he will become president, and so on. They didn't feel the need to think about it. In fact, they were quite bored by that kind of dreary nation-building thinking. And as they thought about it, they imagined that there would be a very short occupation, and freedom would flower, and freedom was there in their sense of it. And the US wouldn't have much more to do with it after that. They would say, okay, now it's for Iraqis to sort out. Now, the people who'd in the State Department and elsewhere who'd been more sceptical about going to war were the ones who thought, well, actually, this is an extremely naive idea. Actually, you have to plan it a lot more than that. And once the invasion had taken place, the balance of power within the US administration shifted over to these people who'd been more sceptical about going to war, but who wanted to plan it more. And the sheer disaster that took place that unfolded over the subsequent years was largely the brainchild of these people who'd been sceptical about going to war, the people in the State Department and the CIA. And so the plans, for instance, to sectarianize Iraqi politics, to say, if you're going to be in the government, you've got to either represent the Shia or the Sunnis or the Kurds. This really came from the State Department, who were trying to find a means of governing Iraq, which had a lot more in common, for instance, with the divide and rule of the British Empire 100 or 200 years earlier. But I think the really interesting thing there is that although it was the Defense Department, although it was the neoconservatives who committed the unforgivable crime of starting an unprovoked war, once the war had taken place, on most neoconservatives' idea, things wouldn't have been so bad if the US had then withdrawn and left it to Iraqis to sort it out. I'm sure Ahmed Jalabi wouldn't have lasted very long if they'd installed him, because Iraqis would have got rid of him while he was so unpopular. The real problems that took place after the invasion were the product of those in the US administration who had opposed the war beforehand. I'm really interested in how that undermines the mainstream narrative that has appeared in lots of books about the Iraq War in the US.
If you're on the fire of the title of the book, and it seemed to me that sectarian division of the country into communities was a very significant element of that fuel on the fire. And certainly the impression that I had gained from absorbing the Western media was that there was much more of a communitarian divide in Iraq before the war, akin to something like Northern Ireland in the 1980s or 90s. And in fact, from what you say, identities were much more fluid and people were much more mixed, and really it wasn't until they started being divided up that those sharp distinctions began to be felt in violent ways.
Well, I set out to write a book about the politics of oil, and as I wrote it I realised that I needed to look at the shape of Iraqi politics more broadly, and sectarianism of course has been at the centre of that in the post-2003 period. As you say, we're encouraged to think, if we read the newspapers, that there are three quite distinct communities which share Arabs, Sunni Arabs and Kurds. And not much intermingling between them. They have fairly homogenous interests and to a significant extent they hate each other. That's what we're encouraged to believe. Now, the more I worked in Iraq, the more I spent time in Iraqis and travelled to Iraq, the more I saw that, especially on that religious axis between Shia and Sunni, those divisions just didn't exist to the extent they were being characterised to us by the media. So I would say actually that the vast majority of Iraqis I have met have either parent or a sibling-in-law or at the very least a friend who is from the other sect. Several of the main characters in this book, they might be Shia and have a Sunni wife or vice versa. And so some Iraqis say that until they were adults, they didn't even know there was a difference. Now, I'm not saying that sectarian thinking didn't exist before 2003. It's not quite as simple as that. But before 2003, it just wasn't that significant. And what happened in 2003, while the US and Britain were governing Iraq through Paul Bremer, the administrator, they said, well, we need to have an Iraqi body underneath Paul Bremer. How are we going to select them? Well, we need X number of Shia, Y number of Sunnis, and Z number of Kurds, plus we'll throw in a Turkmen and we'll throw in a Christian. And that then will represent Iraq. Iraq will be represented by the Shia, represented by a Shia individual. And actually the way they did that was quite perverse in that, for instance, some of the Shia they selected were members of secular parties who didn't think of themselves as representing Shia. But it was their personal background, but that wasn't their politics. And even who had more Sunni constituency than Shia. So people were kind of forced into these categories. The Turkmen they chose, I got hold of a US government document which I thought was fascinating. They felt they needed to have a Turkmen on this representative council, supposedly representative council, it's called the Iraqi Government Council. Actually, in the case of the Iraqi Turkmen, there was a fairly representative body called the Iraqi Turkmen Front. Now, in this document I got hold of, which discussed the views of one of the architects of this governing council, in Paul Bremer's Coalition for Regional Authority, he said, we thought about getting someone from this representative body, the Iraqi Turkmen Front. We decided, actually, they were a bit too close to Turkey, and Turkey opposed the war, and so we thought we ought to break the back, that's his phrase, we ought to break the back of the ITF. So we found this other person, and actually, she was a woman, and we wanted to have a quota of women on the governing council as well, so she ticked two boxes, so she was not better. But she had no connection, she had no real, certainly no mandate from the Turkmen community, she didn't really have any political connection, she wasn't really a representative at all. But what this illustrated was that the thinking of the Americans and the Brits at that point was, well, if she's Turkmen, then she represents the Turkmen people of Iraq, even if she's not got those political connections. The head of the Iraq Communist Party happened to be Shia, even though he's secular and doesn't organise in religious terms and would hate the idea of organising in religious terms, but he was one of the Shia representatives on this council. So politics became about what is your personal identity, and through that personal identity, ethnic or religious, you are expected to represent the interests of that group. And from that point, those, at a political level, interests became ever more sectarianised, ethno-sectarianised. Politics became about personal identity, and alongside that, the struggle for power, while formal political power in the institutions of quasi-government and eventually government became determined by sect and ethnicity, so too the fighting on the streets, a sectarian conflict developed over the next couple of years, which got worse and worse, which reflected that. But the real starting point of creating that conflict was saying politics is about sect or ethnicity. And that happened in 2003.
The Iraqi oil industry, the way you describe it, before the war, didn't benefit from a lot of Western technology and expertise, and yet somehow seemed to function. As you describe it as an industry which is sort of held together by a lot of goodwill, dedication, inventiveness, improvisation. How would you describe the Iraqi oil industry today?
In the book, I talk a lot about the fantastic engineering skill of Iraqis. I saw this time and again, both when I travelled to oil installations in Basra, but also when I talked to the experts who've been running the industry. And through hardship, they succeeded in running it very well. As one of the experts put it to me, he said, "We were not engineers, but craftsmen. While there were wars going on, while there were sanctions, they found ways of making the thing work." Now, what happened after 2003 is that the majority of that expertise was lost. It was lost because after 2003, especially after the Americans and Brits set up this sectarian Iraqi Governing Council, jobs within the oil ministry and the oil companies in Iraq, as in all other government institutions, became determined by politics, family and sect. So the Iraqi Governing Council was formed in July 2003. It had 25 members, and there were 21 government ministries at the time. They were invited to appoint ministers to these 21 ministries. And the first thing they did was they said, "Well, there's 21 ministries, there's 25 of us. Let's add another four ministries so that we can each select one." So each member of the Governing Council selected a member of their family or a friend to become minister. The ministers then did exactly the same. One of the most senior civil servants in the oil ministry at the time described this period as the invasion of the Chalabis. And an ally, a protege of Ahmed Chalabi, became oil minister at that time by the name of Ibrahim Bakr-Alroum. And what he did was he cleared out a lot of the old guard through the process of de-Ba'athification. And it was used not just to remove senior members of the Ba'ath Party or those who had blood on their hands. It was used to wholesale remove, to clear out the old guard, and with it a lot of the expertise.
Greg, you call the final section of the book The Iraqi Soul, and I wondered how you felt the Iraqi soul was faring in all of this. Because, one of the attractions of the book is you have such a lot of first-hand contact with real Iraqis. So how is it faring, would you say?
Well, I've worked in Iraq for about 8 years now. Some of that time has been extremely traumatic. It's been awful. You see a country in which I've now got many friends absolutely torn apart. Its social fabric just wrenched into these new categories that are expected to fight each other and have fought each other. You've seen killing and torture on an enormous scale. But what's happened here for observers of Iraq is, of course, there has been a massive anti-war movement. There's been a lot of concern about what our government has done in Iraq, the Americans have done in Iraq. And since about 2007-08, this thing that's been called Iraq fatigue has set in. There's just been so much trauma that people have felt, "I can't engage in it anymore. It's too awful." Now, my experience has been different from that. Although I've experienced that trauma, I think I've also been exposed to cause for hope. And that's through spending time with Iraqis. Now, as I've described, the Iraqi soul is not sectarian in the way we're led to believe by what's written in the newspapers. Actually, what I've seen is a political culture that I think is way ahead of our home. When I travel to Iraq and I talk to people, I visit them in their homes, they want to talk about politics, and they know a hell of a lot about politics. Far more than if you try to chat to someone in Britain. Not only that, I think they have an understanding of how to shape it, a desire to get together and work to make their country better. Now, there's an old bigotry that Arabs don't do democracy. What I saw over the years I worked in Iraq is I think ordinary Iraqis have far more capacity for democracy or far more desire for democracy in a genuine sense, where they engage in politics and debate politics and influence politics than people do in other parts of the world. Now, I think that's really resonated over the last 2 months in the rest of the Arab world, as we've seen the uprisings in Tunisia, Egypt and elsewhere, that actually there is this really powerful capacity and desire for political engagement and democracy in its broadest and most genuine sense within Arab culture. The problem is, it's not that Arabs don't do democracy, it's that they've got these dreadful leaders who are extremely self-interested, extremely corrupt, base their power in overseas relations, whether that's with the Americans, whether that's with other neighbouring countries, whether it's with Russians. At different stages, the Arab elites, the politicians, the leaders, have drawn their power from outside, from purchasing arms, from being propped up, from other forms of overt or covert influence by outside powers. And so I think, especially the American narrative of Iraq, is that what America has tried to do is work with Iraqi politicians to try and bring about reconciliation between its divided population, these divided communities who have these ancient and extreme tribalist views of each other. Looked at from an Iraqi perspective, it's the other way round. Ordinary Iraqis are far more reasonable than that. That these great divisions don't exist anywhere near the extent we're told they do. And it's Iraqis who have to keep their politicians apart. The politicians are the ones who are extremely self-interested, who think about themselves in terms of sex and ethnicity. And so, where are we now in terms of the Iraqi soul? Well, Iraqis have been through a terrible time, especially the last 8 years and before that. You know, they've had 30 years of dictatorship, 3 wars, and now they've had a country that has been riven by sectarianism, imposed from outside, with politicians who are at best incompetent and at worst corrupt, extremely self-interested, and they didn't want to do anything for the country. Now, Iraq is different from the rest of the Arab world in that there were elections last year. But there have still been demonstrations in Iraq over the last month or 2 months. It's complicated because leaders have been elected. But what happened was, I think, the hope that was vested in the elections in March last year was dashed immediately after the elections as the politicians who led the parties that had been most successful immediately went to neighbouring countries and started negotiating how those countries would prop up their power in subsequently. It took them 8 months to form a government after that election while they were haggling over who would have power. Iraqis in the early part of this year, and in fact in summer last year as well, before the Arab Spring, have gone out on demonstrations to say, we don't want corrupt politicians. We want politicians who will deliver basic services to us. We still only get 4 hours of electricity per day. Well, some of the demonstrations last summer, which were precursor to what's happening now, the protesters went out on big marches of thousands of people. Some of them carried chairs as a symbol, and they raised these chairs above their head. And what that was about was they were saying the politicians don't care about the services that we're concerned about. We want electricity, we want water, we want security. The politicians are haggling about which of them has a seat in government, and so it's about the chairs. There are protests going on in Iraq at the moment. I think in the short term, I think things look quite gloomy for Iraq because of the political structures that have been created where there are these corrupt and self-interested politicians. I think in the more medium term, and certainly the long term, I think the future of Iraq is much more hopeful. And that's something I've really tried to capture in the book. Because when you look at the Iraqi soul, when you look at the way ordinary Iraqis are, how they think, how they talk, how they work together, I think there's a very great hope for the future of the country and I believe in at some point, and I hope it's sooner rather than later, they'll get rid of these dreadful politicians they've got at the moment and genuinely create a much more functioning and much more inclusive Iraq that is completely at odds with the one that the Americans and Brits have created over these last 8 years.
I was talking to Greg Muttit about Fuel on the Fire, Oil and Politics in Occupied Iraq. It's out now in paperback, and I highly recommend it to anyone with an interest in current affairs and world politics. You can find out more about the book, plus several million others, by going to blackwell.co.uk. That's all for this edition of the programme. But there's a huge sound archive of around 150 interviews for you to explore on the Blackwell's website. Click on the podcast tab on the homepage to visit the archive. I hope you'll join me again soon for another Blackwell Online podcast. And until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.